Coming up on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, we're talking about the science of anesthesia with Dr. Emory Brown from Harvard Medical School. That's up next on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode 140, recorded Thursday, April 19th, 2012. Num, num, num. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I am Dr. Kiki, and this is a show where you get to delve in for the better part of an hour to a subject in the sciences, a single subject with a single expert for a whole hour. It doesn't happen very often in this world, so I hope you are set up, prepared, ready to listen, because we're going to dig in, right? We're going to get deep into this subject, and today's subject is the science of anesthesia, and we're joined today by our guest, Dr. Emory Brown from Harvard Medical School and MIT. But, you know, before we get into the conversation, we have a few science headlines. It's April 19th, 2012, and this is the science that made headlines this week. First up, a report from the University of British Columbia looked at data for jellyfish populations over the past 50 years in 45 marine ecosystems around the world. The numbers of the tentacled creatures are on the rise in 62% of the areas looked at in the study. Most of these areas are heavily impacted by human activities. Publishing in the journal Nature, Dr. Lee Miller of Northwestern University describes his latest in his lab's endeavors to develop precision prostheses, neuroprostheses. In this study involving monkeys, the group bypassed the spinal cord using a brain-computer interface to record neural activity responsible for hand-wrist movement connected to a functional electrical stimulation device to drive muscle contractions and restore complex hand movements disabled by paralysis. Let's face it, orangutans are smart. In a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers suggest that the primates use knowledge about the properties of tree branches and how they break to create sturdy, comfortable nests for sleeping. Obviously, they are a more highly evolved life form since they use their mental powers for sleep. A giant solar flare exploded out of the sun this week and was captured in video by NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory. The eruption registered M1.7, but was not pointed toward the Earth. There have been larger solar flares that we've seen, but this one shows that there is a lot of activity going on. And the event confirms that a highly active area of the sun is rotating towards us. Where do cosmic rays come from? Well, scientists still don't really know. Data from the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory of 307 gamma ray bursts seems to bust the leading hypothesis, which posits that cosmic rays are emitted during gamma ray bursts when stars collapse into black holes or when black holes produce outward particle jets. Theory predicts that neutrinos should be produced and ejected at the same speed as the gamma rays. However, Ice Cube only detected neutrinos at 24 and 27% of expectations. Similarly, a study to be published in the Astrophysical Journal has found no evidence of the dark matter predicted to exist around our sun. The study used the MPG ESO 2.2-meter telescope at the ESO's La Silla Observatory to accurately map the movements of over 400 stars as far away as 13,000 light-years. Based on the results, either this study has flaws or current models of dark matter are incorrect. A paper published in the archive database and soon expected to be published in the journal Nature reports the sighting of the earliest known galaxy by the Hubble and Spitzer telescopes. Magnified and made visible by galactic lensing, the distant galaxy appears just 490 million years after the Big Bang. The shuttle Discovery took its final flight from Kennedy Space Center this week atop a 747 jet, which carried it to its new home in the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. A meta review of 600 papers investigating the relationship between gum disease and cardiovascular health finds that gum disease does not raise the risk of heart attacks or stroke. The review also found that many of the studies available were flawed in some way. Scientists at the Gladstone Institute report that they successfully transformed damaged scar-forming cardiac muscle cells into healthy heart muscle cells in mice. The experiment involved delivery of three genes for embryonic heart development to cells damaged by cardiac arrest. According to researchers, their next step is to test the technique in larger animals with bigger hearts, and eventually they hope to completely do away with heart transplants in humans. But in the meantime, just be happy. A review from the Harvard School of Public Health of more than 200 studies published in Psychological Bulletin suggests a link between psychological well-being and fewer heart problems, with the most optimistic individuals experiencing up to 50% lower risk for heart disease. Finally, British researchers report the creation of six DNA and RNA analogs, otherwise known as xenonucleic acids, or XNAs, and polymerase enzymes, which were able to transcribe the synthetic DNA into natural DNA and then back again to synthetic code, in effect evolving more efficient synthetic molecules. This study demonstrates the potential for creating synthetic life that passes information from generation to generation and evolves, and the possibility of finding alien life based on nucleic acids different from our own. And that does it for the science headlines this week. Let me know what you think about the science news stories, or tell me what you think should be science news by sending me an email at drkiki@drkiki.tv or leave me a voicemail at 650-741-5454. Now for a word from our sponsor. We'd like to thank Netflix for sponsoring this episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. Which means there are several easy ways that you can instantly access Netflix and their collection of streaming movies and TV shows. You can watch Netflix and their shows on your Mac, PC, iPad. There's an iPad app, your iPhone, there's an iPhone app, and there are even apps for some Android devices that you can find in the Android marketplace. If you have a gaming console, you can use your Xbox 360, PS3, or your Nintendo Wii. If you're not a gamer, though, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV, or you can use one of the inexpensive and easy-to-use boxes like the Roku box or Boxy box. And with Netflix, you can watch any movie or TV show instantly using any of these devices. And one of the really neat things that you can do with Netflix is start watching on one device, and if you get interrupted, stop at any point in the program and pick it up right where you left off on any device. It's a really seamless experience. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time for absolutely free. And they're giving you a special offer. You can try Netflix right now, 30 days for absolutely free. That's right, 1 month for free if you go to netflix.com/twit. You have to use this URL, though, to get the special deal. So go to netflix.com/twit and get your 30 days free from Netflix. And we thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. And now to get into our show, I'm joined today by Dr. Emery N. Brown. He's an MD and PhD, and he is an anesthesiologist at the Massachusetts General Hospital with a primary research interest in the mechanisms of general anesthesia. He is Warren M. Zappel Professor of Anesthesia at Harvard Medical School, Professor of Computational Neuroscience at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Professor of Health Sciences at Technology at the Harvard MIT Division of Health Sciences and Technology. He's been inducted into the Institute of Medicine, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and also into the IEEE as a fellow. Dr. Brown, thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me.
You're welcome. So let's jump right into this. What is anesthesia?
Well, general anesthesia is a condition that we create so that patients can humanely undergo many surgical and non-surgical procedures. So we think of it as having about five or six characteristics. First, you are unconscious. You're not supposed to perceive what's going on while the surgeon is operating on you. You also are, you have amnesia. You can't remember what happens. You also are, we make it so that it's not painful for you. And it's nice if you're not moving around while the surgeons are operating. Then we do all those things and maintain stability of the physiological systems, heart rate, blood pressure, respiration, and functioning of the kidney. So it's that constellation of behaviors and physiological states that we call general anesthesia.
How did you get interested in anesthesia? Where did that start?
Well, it started when I was in college. On my senior honors thesis that I wrote when I was a Harvard undergraduate was sponsored by the Department of Anesthesia at Mass General Hospital. And as a consequence, I had contact very early on with the anesthesiologist there, and in particular, Dr. Jack McPeak. And then later on in medical school, when I came back to do my rotations on the anesthesia service, I really liked it and decided that was what I wanted to do. I enjoyed the physiology. I enjoyed, you know, taking care of patients in that particular setting. So I decided it's what I wanted to do for a career.
I've heard that anesthesiologists are a very special kind of doctor because they are very focused on not just the body and the health of the patient, but the brain as well. Would you agree with that?
Not entirely.
No.
I think that our emphasis on the brain is more recent. I think in terms of understanding how anesthesia works. I think the fair statement is, as anesthesiologists, we're whole body physiologists. As I said, we have to maintain a state of what we call homeostasis or a balance of physiology. And to do that, it means taking care of the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, you know, the entire body, the pain systems. Mm-hmm. But as far as focusing on the brain and understanding how anesthesia works, I mean, we've probably put less emphasis there.
Why do you think there's been so little emphasis or less emphasis on the brain?
Well, I think it's because over time we've had to solve some hard problems. You know, there was a time, at least there was a perception that, you know, anesthesia was a near-death experience and nothing could be further from the truth now. Anesthesia administered by anesthesiologists is quite safe because we go to great lengths to monitor you and maintain you in a stable physiological condition. And that means that we know how to take, as I said, we know how to take care of the heart. We know how to take care of the lungs. We know how to manage problems when they arise. Mm-hmm. And what has occurred is that those problems were harder, more immediate problems. And then the issues of how the drugs were, let's say, acting in the brain are only now being focused on to the degree that, you know, that's going to allow us to understand their actions, I guess is the way I would put it.
Yeah, and when I think of what's happening with anesthesia, you either you're inhaling a gas or you're having something injected into your bloodstream, but the actions aren't necessarily taking place in your bloodstream or in your lungs. The molecules of the drugs are actually making their way to the brain, and that's where they're actually having their impact.
That's right. So because the drugs are injected or they're inhaled, they're free to go everywhere. Mm-hmm. So the primary anesthetic effects are in the brain and in the spinal cord. But in addition, they have effects in other parts of the body, which some of which contribute to, you know, some of the side effects. As a very straightforward example, very often when we administer an anesthetic to you, whether it's an inhaled drug or a drug that we give you intravenously, it causes the blood pressure to go down.
Right.
And that's not because it's acting in the brain, but because it may be acting on the heart as well, or on the blood vessels to dilate them.
Right.
So exactly. So that, so they act and go everywhere. But the anesthetic effect, as you're suggesting, is in the brain and the spinal cord.
So what kind of drugs are currently used, and what kind of actions do they have?
So the first public demonstration of anesthesia took place in 1846, October 16th, in Mass General Hospital. And in that demonstration, the drug that was used by William Morton was ether. And I just mentioned that just because the inhaled drugs that we currently use now, let's say isoflurane, sevoflurane, and desflurane, are ether drugs. So that has evolved. There have been other inhaled drugs that have been used, but we're still using descendants of ether for inhaled drugs. And then for the intravenous drugs, there are about maybe three, four main categories. Those that really render you unconscious in one fell swoop if you give a bolus, like a single large injection. So those would be drugs like propofol.
Mm-hmm.
The other ones, which you may have heard of, are the drugs like the barbiturates. And then the others, the third kind of major class are the benzodiazepines. So these are drugs, these are Valium-like drugs,
right,
which are used as sedatives, but in higher doses can you know, make you unconscious the same way that propofol would.
Right, and propofol is the drug that in popular news recently, we know that Michael Jackson took that.
Right, it's been associated with Michael Jackson's demise. Yes, that's right. And the other category of drugs that I wanted to mention are the opioids, the drugs which we primarily use to treat pain. So we think of morphine and either various synthetic opioids, the fentanyls or semi-synthetic opioids like Dilaudid and these drugs. And then there are other sort of sedatives that are used, like dexmedetomidine, which is a fairly relatively newer drug. But those are roughly the categories. So inhaled drugs, intravenous drugs, and within the intravenous drugs, maybe these more potent sets, which we call hypnotics, the analgesics, or which are primarily the opioids, which we use to treat pain, and then another sets of sedatives.
I'm familiar with fentanyl from my when I gave birth to my son. Fentanyl was something that was offered by the hospital. I wish it had been a little stronger.
Well, we have other ways of probably doing that now, which are quite effective.
so there are many different categories of drugs and many different types of effects that they have. When you talk about the different effects, sedative or otherwise, the effect for anesthesia that you want is for the patient to become unconscious.
That's right. Unconscious, not remember, and also not feel pain. I mean, if we said
no pain, no memory of pain, and not responding.
Exactly. And so we do that by using a combination of drugs. So, for example, we could do all of that by just using the inhaled drugs by themselves. But that comes at the price of having more side effects. So what we've learned over time is the way to mitigate the side effects is to use the drugs in combinations. And what we've come to appreciate is that allows us to have most of the good effects and fewer of the side effects. So that's why we would use drugs, combinations of drugs from different categories, to generate this condition of general anesthesia.
What brain areas are you affecting when the drugs actually take effect?
So let's speak specifically about a drug like propofol.
Mm-hmm.
So it, as we talked earlier, goes into the blood vessels. And then once it's into the blood vessels and it gets into the brain, it turns out it's very, very soluble. In other words, it can leave the blood and go easily into the tissue. It's very, very soluble in fat, so it passes very easily into the brain. And there, anywhere that there are specific receptors that it binds to, which are, in this case, GABA-A receptors, it can have an effect. So that can be anywhere from the spinal cord all the way up to the brain. And we can associate the effects that we see with the actions of the drugs in different parts of the brain. So just to illustrate this, when you give someone a substantial dose of propofol, one of the first things you notice is they stop breathing. And that's because it's having an effect in the lower part of the brainstem called the medulla. That's where our respiratory centers are. Then if you look the next sort of effects that you see, the person at the same time they would stop breathing would become unconscious. And that can be caused by effects in a number of areas. The upper part of the brainstem, where the arousal pathways start, okay, or in the cortex where we integrate information or we process information to reason about it, the cortex and the thalamus. So the drug freely flows through the blood, freely enters the brain and spinal cord tissue, and has effects at multiple sites that way.
And then depending on what site it's affecting, you'll have a variety of different effects.
That's indeed the case. You know, so let's just, to be very specific, let's say you are unconscious once you've gotten propofol. The drug has had an effect in the cortex, the upper part of the brain, and it's had an effect in the brainstem. So both of those in concert are probably responsible for being unconscious under propofol.
When people are talking about being under unconscious, under anesthesia, how do you know that somebody is unconscious? How are you monitoring all of the brain states?
So, I mean, that's a very, very good question. And it's a question that there's not a consensus opinion on in our field. So the first way that we do it is based on the clinical signs. That is, is the person responding, have the physiological signatures, blood pressure, heart rate, come down and now they're stabilized so that the surgeon could start operating. So that's the crudest level, right? Then the more detailed level, or the more insightful level, is using monitoring with the electroencephalogram. So based on the brainwave patterns that you see, you can have a very good idea of whether or not the person is unconscious. So this is using indices that are derived from the electroencephalogram are fairly common, but using the electroencephalogram directly is a lot less common.
Right.
I think the latter is probably is a more insightful way to really know that a patient is unconscious under general anesthesia.
Yeah. Are there very specific brain patterns that you can take a look at that you can actually see when you're looking at an EEG readout to know that somebody is under?
Most definitely. So some of these have been known for years, but they haven't come widely into practice. There's a very interesting phenomenon that occurs as a person's brain becomes anesthetized. The EEG patterns, this isn't the way it's normally done. So this is what is normal. You can see in a research setting, but you can see elements of this that you can monitor in the operating room. The EEG patterns start from the back of the head and they move forward. And the activity becomes more intense or much more active in the front of the head. This is a process that's called anteriorization. It's been known about for over 30 years. And then if you were to put electrodes on the front of the brain, you would see two very strong rhythms, one which is called an alpha rhythm, which is about 10 cycles per second, and another one which is called the slow or delta oscillation, which is anywhere between 1 to, let's say, 4 cycles per second. So those two rhythms, when you observe them, it's very likely that the patient is unconscious.
Okay, so it's very unlikely. So it's not absolutely certain, but you've got a very high probability of unconsciousness.
Well, I'm fairly certain that that's the case, to tell you the truth. I mean, the only reason I phrase it that way is that, you know, the sorts of studies that are done where they actually show under, you know, extremely large number of patients looking at this particular marker that the person would be unconscious. But, you know, our research studies suggest that particularly if you think about this 10 hertz oscillation, mm-hmm. you know, our thesis is that it occurs because the brain is locked into a rhythm, which is 10 cycles per second, or roughly around cycles per second. When this occurs, it would be next to impossible to be unconscious if the oscillation is occurring the way our modeling work suggests.
Right.
So should I just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love that.
So here's the way to think about it. You and I are having a conversation right now, and my voice is using a certain set of frequencies, and the frequencies are being modulated, okay? And that allows me to communicate and transmit information to you. Mm-hmm. Now, suppose what we were to do is to shrink that down to a single frequency with a fixed amplitude. It would be like a hum. It would be like a just a fixed amplitude, all right? Now, if I try to have the same conversation with you, I can't do it, okay? Because everything is at a fixed frequency. It's just a hum. So what is this analogous to? So you've probably seen patients that have had seizures. And very often, if you look at the EEG when the patient sees, particularly if they have like absence seizures, the EEG becomes very, very regular. It's regular over a large part of the head. So the idea that a very regular oscillation could be causative of or associated with a state of unconsciousness is well known clinically. So the idea that, in this case, an anesthetic generating oscillations like this could be responsible for unconsciousness is likewise very, very plausible.
It's just fascinating that we can generalize, you know, the signals from the outside of the brain to what potentially is happening inside the brain. I love the go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that's what we really need to do. We need to, you know, do the studies that give us insights mm-hmm. into what's going on inside the brain using imaging techniques or maybe studies in animals that allow us to really understand what these signatures on the surface are telling us, so that when we go in to take care of patients, you know, there's no guessing. We can be certain as to what state the patient's brain is in or whether or not he or she is comfortable. I think that's imperative.
Yeah. Do you think now, it sounds from what I see in the literature, it seems as though there's more scientific research occurring in looking at what's going on when somebody's under anesthesia, what is happening when they're unconscious, how do you differentiate between unconscious and or conscious, just not able to respond or move.
Right.
And do you think that with the growth in this field of research, we will see less and less of the stories of people saying, oh, I was awake but couldn't move, and I couldn't respond during my open heart surgery, but I remember the whole thing and it was really painful? You know, you hear a lot of those.
Yeah, well, what you hear is that when you hear about it, it gets a lot of attention.
Right, there's always
Right, in point of fact, it's an extremely rare occurrence, you know, maybe 1 in 10,000, you know, 2 in 15,000 or something like that. And so I think that you're certainly correct. As we are able to understand more precisely what these brain signatures mean, we will be in a much better position to make sure that those types of situations don't occur.
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of research is currently ongoing that might lead us in that direction?
Well, I think there are a couple of areas which are very exciting. You know, quite important. You know, there are a number of investigators who are using imaging techniques. You mm-hmm. mentioned looking inside the brain to try to understand what's going on, using imaging to try to understand what areas are activated or inactivated as patients are under anesthesia, using, you know, the electroencephalogram And as we come to understand more of the biophysics of the electroencephalogram, then learning to interpret it and also getting better insights into also what areas are activated, you know, or inactivated. And then, you know, in invasive studies that we can do, you know, only in animals where we mm-hmm. place electrodes in particular brain regions to try to understand how does the activity in those areas change when patients are under anesthesia. I think these types of investigations, which would fall under the heading of systems neuroscience, are really where the future for understanding the mechanisms through which anesthetics act in the brain truly lies.
In the research that you've been doing, you've the focus of your laboratory is involved in looking at statistics and probability, and you mentioned the biophysics of these EEG signals. Can you talk a little bit about the signal processing that you have to do and the methods that you're using to study anesthesia?
Yes, for sure. So I'm a statistician and an anesthesiologist. So as you're suggesting,
yeah.
my laboratory works on, you know, doing studies to try to understand what happens under anesthesia. And aside from that, we've worked for a number of years developing signal processing algorithms to help mostly neuroscientists understand the structure in their data and analyze their data more effectively. And so naturally, we started doing our own experiment. We started focusing our energies more on the data that we were collecting. And when you have, you know, many leads of electroencephalogram that you're collecting through time, there can be a potentially challenging, you know, signal processing question. So we do some very standard things, you know, spectral analysis, certain types of modeling techniques in what's called the time domain to try to understand the structure. And so the idea is to try to understand what ways can you look at the data such that as a patient's brain is moving through different states, you can find signatures, markers that tell you what those brain states are. So mm-hmm. that's kind of the spirit of what we're doing.
Is it easy to find? You're working with data in your own laboratory and setups in your own experiments, but is it easy to generalize those across different laboratories so that it's really a methodology that that any neuroscientist could use?
We haven't done that yet, but I would say that it is. And the reason I'd say that it is because there's empirical evidence for that. So beginning in the mid-90s, commercial interests produce brain monitors that are marketed today that basically process electroencephalogram and effectively, you know, near real time, and then give you out an index that gives you some notion of how deep the patient is under general anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
So just the fact that you could produce a monitor like that that has an algorithm that analyzes the signal in near real time suggests that it's going to be very plausible to have standardized algorithms that could be used that might do, you know, more detailed processing that would give exactly the same results across multiple laboratories. Because remember, the effects of the drug on the brain are not subtle.
Yeah.
They are very obvious. In many cases, they're quite global. They're not local. So the fact that you could come up with very reliable markers to track what the brain is doing under anesthesia is a very plausible problem to solve.
In your other research, I have a background in studying the avian hippocampus, the bird in the bird brain, but mm-hmm. you've looked at the hippocampus, and I was just wondering, you know, how that plays into anesthesia, if at all.
Well, the hippocampus plays tremendously into anesthesia. Mm-hmm. I think the work that I've done on the hippocampus hasn't connected up yet. I mean, when the work that I've done on the hippocampus has been mostly in collaboration with Matt Wilson at MIT and Lauren Frank at the University of California, San Francisco. And there, you know, those two neurophysiologists are interested in the question of how does the hippocampus function to help us encode, you know, short-term memories. And so a lot of the work that we did there was trying to study how the rat hippocampus represents or maintains a dynamic representation of space. The rats brain has these special neurons in the hippocampus, which are called place cells or place neurons, and they spike based on where the animal is in its physical space. So you could imagine that if you collected enough data from these neurons simultaneously, or signals from them simultaneously, you could use neural activity to figure out where the animal was in space. And studying problems like that gives us some idea of how the hippocampus represents short-term memory information. In the long run, it would be nice to know that there is some way we could tell from things we could measure on the surface whether or not the hippocampus is inactive. Because if the hippocampus is inactive, it's highly unlikely that you would be able to form memories. You would certainly have amnesia under general anesthesia. Mm-hmm. So that's something which we're working towards, but I don't think I have an answer for that yet.
Yeah, I think it would, if you could monitor something, like in the bird brain, the hippocampus is right on top of the brain. And so if you wanted to study it with electrodes, it would be very easy. But in human brain, it's a pretty deep structure. So
yeah, because the human brain is folded under, and so it's more almost on the underside of the cortex. Yeah.
Yeah. So monitoring hippocampal activity specifically would probably be a really neat trick to be able to get that information out of something like an EEG.
Yeah, it would be, but you know,
you'll get there.
We'll think about it. We'll get there.
Excellent. In terms of other interesting aspects of anesthesia and what we're and what you're working on and what you're learning about, last year you had a study that got pretty broad coverage comparing anesthesia and the state of the brain to sleep versus coma. And just in terms of consciousness versus unconsciousness, I was just wondering if you could comment on it briefly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with my colleagues, Nico Schiff at Cornell and Ralph Leidig at the University of Michigan, we wanted to do an analysis to try to make a clean statement about what is the relationship between general anesthesia, sleep, and coma. And I think one of the main points we wanted to make was that general anesthesia and sleep are not the same thing. You know, very often you may hear anesthesiologists talking to patients because they're using a euphemism to refer to the state of unconsciousness or lack of awareness that a patient is going to have when he or she's under general anesthesia. But really that state's probably better referred to as being unconscious, because in point of fact, because you are insensate, that is, you don't feel pain, you don't form memories, you're not conscious, that is technically a state of coma. And that's what general anesthesia truly is. It's a state of reversible coma. And so one of the things that we wanted to do is we give the drugs to bring you into that state, and then we let the drugs wear off so that you can come out of that state. And that's what you really need to be in if you think about how traumatic it would be to try to undergo like a major surgical procedure with, you know, without being in that state. So a frank conversation about what general anesthesia is and the neurophysiology that might underlie the mechanism of certain drugs, I think, is important both scientifically as well as for being able to speak openly about what it is we do with the public.
Yeah, and I read a couple of articles in which you were interviewed, and you said that anesthesiologists should no longer say, "I'm putting you to sleep now." It should be just changed from that, and like you said, say, "You're going to be unconscious," or
you'll be unconscious. You will be unconscious. You will not feel pain. You're not going to have any idea. You're not going to remember what's going on to you. But you know, I can assure you that you're going to be, you know, physiologically stable. We're going to to make sure of that. I think, and if you think about what you're doing, is when I say that, what I'm doing when I'm doing that, I'm actually explaining to you what general anesthesia is. And I think that the public is very sophisticated now, and they would appreciate that as opposed to just some sort of euphemistic statement about, you know, you're going to sleep. Because at some point, the public becomes very, very savvy. And if someone asks you, am I really asleep? And the answer is, you know, is no. And so
You're probably really not to, dreaming.
Right. We need to use the words to truly reflect what it is we're doing.
Yeah. Do you think after comparing these different brain states and coming to the conclusion that it is more like a coma to be under anesthesia than it is to be like be asleep, do you think mm-hmm. that anesthesia and looking at anesthesia can actually give us insight into what happens during coma?
I think that is possible. So I guess one of the ways to think about it is there are many ways that patients could end up in a coma, and one of them might be through drugs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for example, just that a patient that, you know, has an overdose of, you know, alcohol who ends up in a comatose state, you know, that's, you know, precisely what happens. So I think there can be some insights gained into, like, the states of coma from, you know, studying general anesthesia. Is it a perfect model for all states of coma? No, but by understanding how this state of coma is generated by anesthesia, it's going to help us understand the brain, which is certainly going to inform us more about, you know, the states of coma that come about for, you know, other pathological reasons.
Right. We were talking a little bit earlier about the different brain states and the oscillations or the waves that you see in the EEG. Mm-hmm. In another recent study that you just published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, you talk about brain metabolism, so energy mm-hmm. management and brain activity, mm-hmm. and how when a brain is under passed out. when it's out there okay. or under low energy use, there is a particular kind of oscillation that you see. And you, right. can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, you're referring to this pattern called burst suppression. And one of the reasons that we wanted to study this in detail is that burst suppression is something that you see in deep states of general anesthesia. It's also something that you see in when patients are hypothermic, when they're in deep states of coma, and also in, you know, children who are born prematurely.
Yeah.
Brains are very often in this state of burst suppression. As they improve, they come out of it. So these are seemingly different states. And so we wanted to come up with an explanation that would suggest why these different states produce this seemingly very, very similar pattern. There seemed to be some sort of common mechanism involved. And one of the things that happens is when it's necessary, when for the purposes of brain protection, we want to place a patient in what's called a medical coma. I mean, this was, you know, a technique that was used with Representative Gabrielle Giffords. Mm-hmm. And she had her head injury last year. We used anesthetic drugs to actually induce that. And you see, what's interesting there is we freely admit that we're creating a medical coma. It's exactly the same therapeutic purposes of protecting the brain. Mm-hmm. And what we know is that when we do that, it actually reduces brain metabolism. So the brain lessens its energy requirements. So we're actually to allow it to rest.
Huh. And so when the brain's resting and it's reducing its energy requirements, there's less oxygen use, there's just less metabolic processes that could lead to further damage.
Exactly. That's exactly what you want to do. So this is a technique, again, someone has had, you know, a traumatic injury to the brain, you might want to rest the brain in that condition. Someone comes in and they're having uncontrolled seizures, to help turn the seizures off, you know, you try to inactivate, rest as, you know, as much of the brain as possible. And so that's why we want it. And when that happens, when you give drugs to induce that, or you see patients in deep states of coma, they're in this activity. You see, is this burst suppression? It shows up as a burst of activity followed by seconds of quiet period, burst of activity followed by, you know, seconds of quiet period. It alternates that way, and that's why it's called burst suppression.
And we do, other than this idea that it works as a protective mechanism or a resting mechanism for the brain, we really have no idea why it arises.
Well, it's interesting to sort of speculate about that a bit. You know, yeah. It seems like, you know, there's something which is perhaps analogous, you know, and when a woman is in labor and you're watching the contractions on the monitor and you're watching a baby's heartbeat. When you have a normal, healthy baby and the uterus contracts, the heart rate actually goes down.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if you think about what's happening physiologically, at the point when the uterus contracts, you're actually reducing blood flow to the baby. And so there's a mechanism, I don't think we completely understand this, whereby when that occurs, the baby reduces its heart rate. And then in lockstep with when the uterus, the contractions subside, you see the rate of the baby come back up.
Right.
So a protective mechanism, you might say, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like the brain is kind of built with something like this intrinsically. You know, teleologically, maybe one of the things that occurs, the reason these babies, when they're born prematurely and they sort of just seemingly show up in the state of birth suppression, this mechanism is in place already and it's actually protecting them.
Hmm.
You know, until they're actually able to function, you know, more normally. I mean, I have no, I don't have any data to support this. I'm just, you know, conjecturing at the moment. But it's interesting that it's seemingly there in place. And when the child improves, the brain improves, they become healthier, these suppressive periods, these birth suppression episodes disappear.
Yeah, and you could speculate that it's some very basic brain pattern, very basic neural pattern that the brain returns to at certain points in time.
Right, it's more than a neural pattern. It seems like it's neural activity coupled to metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of says that, you know, we need metabolism, and when we reduce metabolism, it actually shows up that the manifestation of it is this particular brain pattern, if you see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the protective mechanism is really in terms of the metabolism, the energy pattern turns out to be a marker of being in that state of reduced metabolism.
It's fascinating stuff. Do you love your work? It just sounds so interesting.
I do.
That's great.
Do you want to come and work? Do you want to come and join us? It's tons of fun.
Oh, I know. The other coast, unfortunately, but I would. Yeah, if I were there, be there in a minute.
Okay. All right. So when you're in Boston the next time.
Absolutely. Next time I'm in Boston, I will be getting in touch because I would love to come and visit and see what you're doing.
You have an open invitation.
Thank you so much. We are coming to the end of our hour. We got started a little bit late, but I wanted to find out, get some thoughts from you on, based on where we are now in the science of anesthesia. Where do you see anesthesia going in the future? Do you have your dream for how anesthesia will work?
Yeah, I mean, I see sort of two big directions. I think that there's a major direction within anesthesiology in which we learn more about the brain so that we can design more precise ways to give general anesthesia, which are more focused, which affect only the areas that need to be effective, and we have, you know, many fewer side effects. And as a consequence of that, and understanding more about the brain and more about how the drugs affect the brain, more precise ways to monitor the brain under anesthesia. So I see that as very tractable, and that's anesthesiology. But I also see a much bigger area where anesthesiology intersects more directly than it currently does with other areas of what I would call clinical neuroscience. So if you think of the other disciplines that work on the brain, like psychology, psychiatry, the clinical disciplines, psychology, psychiatry, neurology, neurosurgery, anesthesiology is one of them. And arguably it's the clinical area of clinical neuroscience where there's more direct manipulation of the brain than in any of the others. And as a consequence of maybe us not working as hard until recently to really understand how what we do affects the brain and the various mechanisms, I think two key things have been happening. One, we haven't learned as much from those other disciplines, mm-hmm. and those other disciplines haven't learned as much from us. So I think that as we come more into our understanding better what we do, we're going to be able to contribute more to clinical neuroscience, and clinical neuroscience is going to contribute more to our work in anesthesiology.
I think that doing more research in this area can only benefit everybody. I think it's just something that's so fascinating, and it's something that a lot of people come in contact with in their lives. Many people know somebody who's gone under anesthesia for surgery, or they have undergone anesthesia themselves, and so the understanding of what's going on can just the appreciation of it can trickle out to so many. So I think it's great what you do.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today. This has been really interesting. I love the bringing all of these questions of how the brain works together in this form of study. I think is just fascinating.
Oh, thanks again. So I'll see you in Boston.
Yeah, I will see you in Boston too. I think that's great. And I'd love to thank Dr. Emery Brown for joining us here on Dr. Kiki Science Hour. And if anyone is interested in learning more about what he does, you can visit neurostat.mit.edu. It's one of his websites for research, and you can find more information there. Additionally, you can find information about Dr. Emery at bcs.mit.edu/people/brown.html. Look for Emery Brown in Google, and you will find all sorts of neat information, in addition the studies that he has been involved in. And that about does it for Dr. Kiki Science Hour. We're done here, and it's time for the end of the show. Until next week, we're going to be talking about the psychology of learning. We're going to be talking with Dr. Gary Marcus about his journey from Guitar Zero to Guitar Hero. And that is the title of his book. Let's see. Until next week, you can follow my pursuits in all the social media places. Twitter, I'm Dr. Kiki. Facebook, also Dr. Kiki. And you can find me in Google Plus as Kiki Sanford. You can also subscribe to Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Go to twit.tv/Kiki for past episodes and lots of ways to actually subscribe and download. And please tell your friends. And if this is not enough science for you, I also have another show called This Week in Science Twists. It's on here on the Twit Network every Thursday, 7:30 p.m., where we talk about the weekly science news stories. And that you can find at twists.org. So I will see you next week. Thanks for tuning in to my Science Hour. Remember, I really do only ask for 1 hour a week. And I do hope that this hour makes your world a whole lot more interesting. And now it's time for your science meditation of the week.
Here in my hand is a three-dimensional carbon nanotube sponge material. It's interesting material because it's elastic, compressible, and flexible, very lightweight, but super hydrophobic, which means it hates water, but oleophilic, it loves the oil, and it could be used for environmental oil spill applications.
It's a simple trick, essentially add element of boron into the growth process, and you end up with these sponge-like, sheet-like material that is made of entirely carbon nanotubes, so it's a very porous kind of architecture.
First thing we'll notice is this sponge is super hydrophobic. It hates the water, and even if we would try to submerge it, it still wants to jump out of the water. It really stays dry even after forcing it under the water. It stays very dry. Another interesting function or feature of these materials is they're very ferromagnetic, so you can use a magnet to direct them and control their whereabouts. This is beneficial because it helps us to salvage the carbon nanotube materials. So being able to control their whereabouts with a magnet will also help us control the materials and salvage them once the oil has been absorbed. This is used engine oil I got from a local gas station. And what we're going to do is drop some of this oil into this water and have our sponge nanotube material absorb the oil selectively out of the water. So I'm going to take one of our carbon nanotube sponge materials and drop it right there on the oil. And you'll see immediately it starts to absorb the oil. Just removing the oil out of water is one thing, but we want to be able to reuse this oil and reuse the energy that it withholds. In this way, we could burn it out, or we can squeeze it out and reuse the oil for energy applications. After the sponge had been saturated with oil, we could burn it out to salvage the energy. And the oil inside is being burned, and the carbon nanotube sponge remains intact. It's special because when the burning process goes on, the carbon nanotube sponge material remains, and it's able to be reused for oil absorption once again. So now this is the material after burning. We could now reuse this and put it on top of another oil spill and try to absorb the oil.